Welcome to episode 31 of the SCADI podcast. On this episode, we are getting into the world of career change, where we explore the journeys of individuals who have successfully transitioned into new careers. Today we have a special guest, joining us from within the ranks of our own company. Damian Taylor is SCADI's director, and he sat down with us today to tell the story how he embraced change and found fulfillment in new paths. We hope you enjoy.
Everybody at SCADI, everyone you'll speak to, has extensive financial markets experience. Today, I'm talking to Damian Taylor, who it must be approaching 30 years in the financial markets, I would think, Damian. Is that right?
That sounds frighteningly. That sounds about right. I think that's the classic thing at the top of your CV where you have your sort of bio and you keep kind of going 20 years financial markets experience. Then you're like, oh, bollocks, I need to change it again. So I think 30 might be about right.
30 years. Well, let's wind it back. And I want to ask you, you know, obviously you've seen huge changes over those 30 years. But thinking back to the person that was probably leaving university and trying to work out where to go, what did you study? How did you sort of enter into this sort of discovery of the financial markets and the city that it was for you, or is that something that's always been around? How did that
not
come around?
Really, I mean, so I was at Manchester University, graduated in 1995, and yeah, my parents don't come from a financial background, so it wasn't a sort of, you know, this was the route one must go and, you know, follow that path. And it was more kind of the milk round was coming around when I was at uni, and the banks seemed quite interesting places to go and have a look at. I mean, I read economics, so I suppose that would theoretically be a pathway, although that's very arguable, I have to say, whether it's been any use or not. So I was doing the milk round, and, you know, back then I interviewed someone called Chemical Bank, which doesn't even exist anymore, which is swallowed by
JP Morgan.
Is it JPM? I can't remember.
Yeah, they merged with Chase, I think.
Remember going to do their sort of, they had a day where you went in and had a sort of trial, I suppose, and they sat you in a dealing floor type room, although it wasn't the real dealing floor, obviously, but it was a sort of big-ish meeting room with speakers playing kind of the background chatter of a trading floor, and you got a load of maths to do, basically, which was just converting currencies from X to Y to Z, and it was a sort of just a test how you worked under pressure, if your maths was sort of good enough to have a go. They were a big FX player, you know, that was the, you know, their game, so it was much more, you know, translate, you know, transfer sterling to Deutschmarks back to whatever it was, to yen back to sterling, and it was kind of what were the numbers. And I remember you had, it was pages and pages of this stuff, and I sort of got through some of them, and I think I did all right in that bit because I got through to the next round, which was a sort of interview round, which sort of went okay, I think. But then actually, you know, I never got any further than that. But that was kind of how it was back then. I think these days, seeing your son being interviewed, you know, it's very much sort of online. You know, you've got 2 minutes to prepare and then 10 seconds or whatever it was, 30 seconds to record your video of, you know, your pitch. So it's very different, I suppose, way back then. I didn't get that job, and I was applying actually to Barings, bizarrely, around the time of Leeson. So I remember, I think I put my application form in, and you did back then write an application form, you know, that's how it was. And waking up one morning, reading the papers, and found it had gone under. So I was like, oh, well, I might have to rethink that. Although, bizarrely, as we'll find out later on in the conversation, I did end up at the Venerable Barings, or it wasn't quite called Barings at that time. So, yeah, so I suppose I really fell into the city. It wasn't something I was necessarily looking to do. I think I was, my father always sort of said, you know, go down a sort of professional career sort of type path, become a lawyer or accountant. And I did, I think I applied to one of the accountancy firms and had been made an offer. And then was, you know, through a sort of combination of luck and whatever, I got an interview at a place called Caspian Securities, which was a brand new investment bank that had just set up, and had been set up by Christopher Heath, who of Barings fame. He had left well before the lease, and it was nothing to do with that. He'd, I think, fallen out with the Baring brothers and gone, well, I'm going to go and set up my own investment bank. and its sort of niche would be that it was emerging markets only. So it was quite forward thinking in that perspective. But, I ended up joining there. I mean, in a way, sort of with hindsight, it got its timing wrong because it then ran into the Asian financial crisis, which was just, destroyed it.
What did it look like as a graduate appearing at effectively a boutique, I suppose? Caspian would be a boutique?
Yes, it was. Yeah, it was. Yeah, there were probably, I think I was employee, I don't know, sort of 30, 40-ish or something. It's pretty small, pretty tight-knit crew. I mean, it was the most exciting time of my life. It was amazing. Quite a classic sort of baptism of fire, because I turned up, I'd sort of gone in, been interviewed, blah, 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 jumped through the hoops and been made the offer. I remember Nick Cowan phoning me up saying, right, we're going to pay you the grand sum of 20 grand, which to me was like unthinkable. I mean, I was just like, you're kidding. That's, that's a decent amount of money. So I turned up on a Monday. I can't remember when it was. And sort of came up to reception and Sridhar, my boss at the time, rushed out, said, can you just go walk around the block again, please? I was like, oh, okay. He goes, well, because we're actually the guy you're replacing, we haven't got rid of yet. So it's classic sort of city type thing. I was like, okay, yeah, that's kind of a bit weird. And so
perfectly
I kind of
normal for the 1990s.
Yeah, it was a bit. So I wandered around the block, came out, and the chair was still a bit warm, I think, when I sat down. So it was, yeah, a real sort of baptism of fire. And I don't think you'd probably get away with that anymore.
No,
in this day and age. But yeah, that's where it started. And I just started as a junior analyst. I was quite good with numbers. So, and the product we were trading was a closed-end fund product, which is very sort of, it's not particularly tricky maths, but it's a mathematically driven product. So you're looking at these funds investing around the globe, and they have a net asset value, NAV, and they have a price. And the two diverge because obviously there are a fixed number of assets within that fund. So I was tasked with sort of helping build up a database because they were a brand new bank. They'd seen that it was an area that they felt that they could have an edge in. So we needed to build up a database of all these funds. I think there were about 450 in our universe. And I was tasked with, just doing that, gathering NAVs, this was a sort of baptism of fire.
And just set out the context of that, because obviously this is the 1990s, and now we have such extensive access to data. What's it like in the 1990s doing that kind of exercise?
Very manual. I mean, it sounds ridiculous now. If you wanted to find the NAV history for an Indian closed-end fund, there were no databases. You would phone someone up and they would fax it through to you. And then I would spend the next, 3 hours typing numbers into probably into Excel, and then they were imported. We did have a database that we ran these things through. But there was no, here's an email, here's the link. No, it was literally, it was a fax, quite grainy normally. You're like, God, is that 95.3 or 98.3? I mean, it's, if you think back about it now, it's ridiculous. But anyway, that's what it was. So yes, a lot of the guys there had come from Barings, which had a very successful funds business, and I think profitable. And I think Caspian had thought, well, look, if we can replicate some of that here, and how we tried to do that, and I suppose it was the advantage of being a new entrant. They didn't have legacy systems, all these old crunching things. We could start building a database from scratch. So we built up this database, which took, 3 to 6 months to put all the data together. But we had some very smart IT guys, and we could price the NAVs for these things live, real time, based off not a particularly typical calculation. We weren't even looking at the top 10 holdings and going, how are they moving? We were looking at, they all track an index, so an Indian fund would vaguely have a correlation to the index. You'd look at what the correlation was, you'd go, well, the NAV last week was, X. The market since then is up Y. The correlation to it is 0.85. So we estimate the NAV to be this. But, we could have, from having feeds of live indices, live currencies, we had a pretty good approximation of what these NAVs were, which then allowed our traders to be able to price these things more aggressively. So we could go out to our client base and go, this is what, we think these are here, or, we hear you're a seller, yeah, we'll bid those for you here, because actually we've got a view that you might be underpricing these things. So it gave us a real advantage, and it was a really, I knew kind of nothing about it really. I was just learning on the job, but a really interesting place to start. And yeah, I got to see a bank grow from whatever it was, 30, 40 people to probably 70 or 80. You know, it was really interesting. It was a great baptism of fire. I really enjoyed it. It was one of those, you know, real, you know, you just love coming into work. Just so much to learn. It was that classic sort of, you know, I suppose, hungry young kid starting on the block.
And Caspian was your first place, and then you moved across to ING Bearings. Mm-hmm. Bearings have been taken over by ING, and that was your first trading role, because you weren't trading.
Yeah, at Caspian. So I was still, no, I definitely wasn't trading at Caspian. I was an analyst, just a closed end funds analyst, and I was, our team was bizarrely pinched back by Bearings, who some of them had left to go and do that, and then Bearings pinched them back. It's the classic days. I was listening to a podcast the other day about, I can't remember who it was, but back then teams would be pinched en masse. You know, you would just have, you take the six people that were running LATAM equities or whatever at Bank X, and they'd sort of, you know, disappear for 3 months and then reappear somewhere else. So yeah, Bearings, I think we'd made a bit of a splash at Caspian because of this real-time pricing. Bearings didn't have that. They knew where a lot of this paper was placed, so they were always going to do, you know, good business in it. But anyway, they brought us across, specifically the analyst guys, to help replicate that again. So I came in as an analyst, absolutely, and was there for, I don't know, a year and a half, two maybe, and then the whole team was being pinched again to go somewhere else, and I was in on that deal, but I got to know the head of trading, Nick Cowan, who you know very well, and he, I remember the day we all came in and we were going to resign. It was a horrible thing. It's never particularly nice resigning from a place. And my dealer board lit up, my line lit up, and Nick called me into his office and said, look, I know exactly what's going on. I know that you guys were all about to leave, but actually the work you've done has been really useful. I'd really rather you didn't go. What can we do to get you to stay? And I said, well, I'd like a bit of pay rise, please. And I said, I'd also like to have a go at trading. So that was how I started on a trading book. And I suppose that's where you and I ended up slightly getting together, because when that team left, I mean, this is through my hazy memory, you probably were asked to come across to help just make markets on that book, as there was a hole there. And that was my sort of start on the trading side of things. That's where I started closed end fund trading. And then me and you started prop trading, just general pairs trading, Western European stuff, relative value trading. But is that right? Am I right in remembering
I think that is right. I mean, I think we were, you know, to talk about proprietary trading, we were very much, you know, in a kind of an institution where there wasn't a massive appetite for risk. So it was a lot of kind of risk neutral type activity. And we were able to do some pretty clever things just with, you know, keeping things tight and correlated. But that sort of, you know, that takes you so far. Mm. And what I think is interesting about your background is that really kicked off your entry into the kind of the world of equities and equity trading. And you really are an equities specialist.
Yeah.
And it's all the things that you learnt about, you know, from trading. So, you know, not just you know, how much equities move, but of course it's all the sort of associated costs that you need to be aware of, you know, when you're borrowing stock and when you're making good on dividends and all that kind of stuff. And how did that sort of, you know, for you, did you just pick it up? I'm asking you the question, I can't remember the answer, but for the listeners, how did that sort of come about, and how did you find out about all of that information?
I just picked it up. I think the city's that classic apprenticeship type structure. You know, you sort of, I'd ended up on that desk and I had to prove myself. And so a lot of it was, yeah, going out and speaking to people, trying to work out what to do. You know, a lot of credit goes to you for that. I remember we were certainly on the closed end fund type stuff. We got lumped in a large-ish Chilean closed end fund. And I remember we had to run around and work out, okay, well, actually the top five holdings are 60% of this thing, they've all got ADRs, GDRs, we can go and hedge those out there. And that was a sort of baptism of fire, as in, you know, you can hopefully track the NAV as and then unwind that position. But obviously there are borrow costs involved, there might be dividends kicking around in it, these sort of stuff. So, you, yeah, that was, I remember all that. And then we started trading pairs, you and I. And it was Western European stuff. It's nothing to do with funds. That was, well, this isn't, I'm going to say Vodafone Management. That was a slightly different hat on. It was sort of Deutsche Bank against Dresdner Bank and all that sort of stuff. And that was much more focused on waiting for a trade to get to a level where you thought it had moved out of whack and then putting it on and then unwinding it, hopefully, as it came your way. And that was all to do with being aware of your borrowing costs, as you say, and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, it was, I think you were good at going, well, let's go out and find this stuff. And then it was, you know, it was getting used to how you would execute that, etc. You know, there's a lot of moving parts to these things. So it's just how, you know, picking up slowly as you go along how these things work.
So you were predominantly trading for the house, but then you moved into a kind of flow position. And how was that different? What did you, you know, experience there in terms of, you know, what does it feel like?
Yeah, it's different. So ING Bearings, as we were still called then, I'm pretty sure, you know, was an emerging markets only bank. So that's where it had come from, certainly where Bearings had come from. ING, big Dutch pension fund investment bank, wanted to add a Western European desk. So they added West European sort of agency trading, and I was moved across to help run that as one of the traders. And that's, yeah, it's different from proprietary. You know, you're obviously very client focused, not you yourself. You know, you're hedging out the risk as it comes on, and you're making prices to your sales team. But it's different. You know, you're not looking to make money from things becoming, you know, either cheap or expensive, whatever it is. You're looking there to facilitate business from your client base that are trying to put on, you know, decent sized trades into markets that might be liquid, might not be that liquid. You know, it's trying to then dig out liquidity for these things. So yeah, it's a different hat you're wearing versus the prop. I mean, we could run positions. We weren't purely agency. Some of the places I worked later on were purely agency. We had no risk appetite whatsoever. You know, that was not even within our mandate. So we had a bit of a risk mandate there. But you know, there was, I remember sitting down with a lot of the operations guys 6 months in, and the book was just covered in these tiny positions because someone would come on and said, oh, can I just buy, you know, 50 grand's worth of this, and we'd make them a market, and it would just sit there. And no one really in ops would come along and go, well, you know, we're funding these positions. I remember when I sat down, you remember Kev Bailey? We would sit down and go, you know, I think it was this sort of old-fashioned way of these old schoolish traders going, well, okay, we'll make the price and we'll just sit there and we don't even really know how to book it on a system. Whereas I suppose us young whippersnappers understood the systems, and then you realise that actually there was a lot of wasted capital that was being tied up that was just pointless. You know, I can't even remember if there was a back book and a front book. I don't think it was, because it's not like we were taking big positions, but there were just a lot of scrappy positions. And if you're running a position in 250 Vodafone, something tiny, but then it's, you know, there's been three dividends since you cleared it and this and that, and some poor guy in ops just had to cover this. So I remember I sat down with Kevin, we spent about a month just unwinding all of this stuff, just cleaning this book up massively. So slight digression there, but it was just, I think
you're right, because it's those other things that people, you know, people understand about the risk taking that goes on, but it's as you say, it's in the peripheral stuff where you can really make a difference. And actually, you know, one of the things that came out of the Asian crisis, which was 1997, was the shock that people experienced when the central banks in Asia started to defend their currencies and put up rates. And the rates were put up to, you know, frightening amounts. And people were, you know, funding their books at overnight rates. And in fact, funding wasn't a trading exercise. It was something that product control did, or finance would at the end of the month would sort of execute a few trades, and that kind of made sense for that era. And it meant that we were in a phase, I think, where traders kind of started to become much more aware of these kind of costs, and also having, you know, how you as a trader could manage those cash balances better if you were the person looking after that stuff.
Yeah, I think that's, yeah, incredibly true. And I think I definitely started to get a feel for the extraneous costs that would exist around trading. And I remember, you know, we ran that pairs book for a while, and I think it was, we really sat down and worked at what our ROCE, or return on capital employed, was. And actually, it was, I think we were pretty efficient compared to a lot of the floor that was just kind of like, well, you know, I bought them here, I sold them there, and I nicked $3,000, and off we go. But it's like, well, actually, there are a lot of costs involved with that. And actually, you haven't that, because you're still you're running a spread trade there, and you haven't unwound it, and you've got all these costs there. So I think it gave me a real feel for, you know, all the costs that exist around the trading side as well. Which then stood me, you know, as we moved through my career, which sort of probably stood me in good stead at much smaller shops that I then went to work at, that were much more focused on that cost. You're trying to make a profit, obviously, and you know your numbers, but you look at your numbers every day, X all the other costs that sit within it. You know, that's, it's not just like, well, I'm a trader, I bought them here, sold them there, I'm going off the pub now, thanks very much.
Well, that was my question, really, because you moved to the buy side after then, and I'm just wondering what your experience was of that kind of stuff versus sort of sitting in a bank where a lot of stuff's taken care of for you by various functions. What's it like moving over to the buy side and into a you know, much smaller operation? Because I mean, how many were you?
We were two. Well, we were. There were two of us. There was a guy that had set it up, Paul, working with me, and then we had a guy that sort of did all our operational stuff. And then a bit further down the line, we hired someone to do marketing for us. So it was a tiny outfit. And certainly when I joined, he'd been sort of looking around at finding prime brokers and that sort of stuff. But we weren't running any money or anything like that. And actually, I think we set up a sort of, our backers put a small amount of money into an account that we were able to trade sort of on a sort of prop basis to try and build up a small track record. But yeah, you're very, very aware of what your costs are, what your execution costs are. You know, we were trading electronically back then. And I hate to think what we're paying, probably 10, 15 bits, which now, you know, given that you're trading more like for under one basis point, I would think these days. But yeah, all those costs start to add up to things. And the strategy we're running was relatively high frequency. I mean, nothing like high frequency as you call it today, but we would hold positions for maybe 1 or 2 days. So actually, you know, if you're churning your portfolio around quite a bit, you know, you need to really be on top of your costs and what your funding rates are and all that sort of stuff. So yeah, absolutely. That's a sort of baptism of fire about learning how some of the plumbing that sits underneath it all works, you know, and how your prime broker charges you and what rate they pay on your cash balance. You know, quite often, certainly back then, I think we were trading a fair amount of the stuff on swap. So in fact, we weren't utilizing too much capital to put these positions on. So our cash balance stayed relatively healthy. But obviously, then you want to try and manage that in an efficient way. There's no point in just shoving it at, you know, 0.001% or something. Your prime broker might offer you something that allows you to have a slight, not enhanced yield above rates, but you might be able to get basically a round base rate for that cash balance. Well, that can add up over the year. You know, if you're getting, I don't know what rates were back then, but they were certainly sort of 4, 5, 6%. So actually, if you're 80% of your capital within your fund is sitting in cash and they can earn that, that's quite useful to pay for a lot of your execution costs, etc., that you might see throughout the year.
I mean, it's amazing to me that in such a short space of time, the exposure that you've had to so many different things, and there's certainly that constant learning curve within a financial career, isn't there?
Yeah.
But none of that's formal training.
No, it's not like, well, I mean, I did some SFA exams, obviously, but no, absolutely. They're nothing to do with trading per se. They're much more regulatory based, as you'd expect. So no, quite. It's you are literally picking up, and then, yeah, you might be. I mean, I started trading a few options around then, so you used to get starting to learn about that sort of side of things. Never really moved to converts, which obviously was your backyard. But I mean, I traded a few of them agency later on in my career. But yeah, you're just learning it up through osmosis, really, through going to go and, you know, chat with the desks, and even back at back trading Western Europe at Barings, you know, you'd go. I would certainly be keen to go and speak to my analysts, find out what they're thinking. You know, what's going on in these names? Why? You know, should we be? What should we be aware of when the results come out? You know, I think you're trying to be proactive as a trader to try and, you know, do the best we could for the book and hopefully for our clients as well. So,
And how, I mean, just, I mean, we've obviously gone a little bit further forward, but just coming back, the other thing I would ask about, I mean, you're sitting on your Western European desk in London hours, yeah. and you're crossing over into New York. How does that work? I mean, what's the relationship with the New York trading desk?
So we were more speaking really to the sales guys out there, unless there was a dual listed stock. So I mean, France Telecom, I think, off the back of my head, had a listing out there as well. Certainly Deutsche Bank did. So yeah, we had back then a hoot and holler system that we could scream through to the New York desk, and they'd probably more likely be screaming at us, trying to, you know, find us some stock. So I mean, you know, we would hand the book to them at the end of the day. So we weren't trading all the way through to US close at all. You know, but they were sourcing hopefully orders for us that we would then look to fill within European hours. And yeah, that was. I mean, I did get a trip out there briefly for a couple, well, I suppose three or four weeks when we looked to launch. I don't know if you remember, we looked to launch, well, the Hong Kong market looked to launch some US equities listed in Hong Kong. So I went and I was sort of put in charge of that. So I was shipped out to New York to meet that NASDAQ trading desk. This is when NASDAQ was, you know, very hot. And then got a trip out to Asia from that to help launch that product. From a trade perspective, so it was quite interesting. Digressing from your question.
No, but that is an interesting. I mean, these are all interesting roles, because I think probably what people aren't aware of is the breadth of what you can get up to in finance, and there are little initiatives along the way that exchanges launch, and these have to be supported, and some will succeed, some won't. But in that, they're all different trading skills, because if you're trading Western European equities in a live market with all of that liquidity, mm-hmm. that's very different from trading in Asia, the NASDAQ market, I guess, after the NASDAQ market is just closed.
Yes,
in terms of real time. And then you're widening the spreads, and I don't know how much risk you're taking. I mean, how did you manage all of that?
Well, this was when the sort of NASDAQ, I mean, it would have been, I'm trying to think what it was. Maybe probably around the, you know, the NASDAQ peak bubble type time period. And I think there were seven stocks, which I'll get them, some of them wrong, sort of a Microsoft, an Amgen, a Starbucks, I think, everyone was looking for 24-hour liquidity then. So whoever had come up with the ideas, like, well, we'll list these things up out in Hong Kong during Asian hours. And ING Bearings had put up his hand to be one of the key market makers in it. So I was sent out to do that. And as you say, yeah, there's, you know, nothing like the liquidity in the States. I remember I was told the day it launched, I think there was some big grand lunch somewhere, and Warren, who'd been in charge of it, had said, look, I'm going to go to this thing and they're going to ring the bell at whatever, 9 o'clock in the morning. And all I want you to do is just get ING up, best bid and best offer on every name. That's all I want. And we'll just try and get it trading. You know, we want our name to be up there making the first few prints. So that was it. But, you know, these were quite widespread. There was no liquidity in these things. I think we did about, you know, we were doing like 40, 50% of the day's volume. But because the market was so hot, you were generally just being lifted. So there were just buyers every day. And then I would let the New York desk know at the end of the day that we'd be taking short this. We'd buy them over there and cover them back. And we were taking sort of 3-4% out of this thing, because there was just that demand out of Asia for it. But, you know, it sounds very grand, but, you know, we weren't trading hundreds and thousands of shares of these things. You know, we might go home short like 5,000 or 10,000. But, yeah, it was very different. And, yeah, an interesting, you know, it's a sort of market-making type job, really, more rather than just a sort of agency trading role. So, yeah, you get the exposure to that as well. So it's funny thinking back about all these things, you know, all the different sort of market forces that you see.
Yeah, interesting. So after that, you moved sort of back across. You had a sort of sojourn into the buy side and then back across into, again, the sort of more boutique-type firms. I'm thinking about North Square.
Yeah.
And then probably larger firms like Seaport. So moving back across to sort of, you know, the boutique side of stuff, how were you still in trading at this point?
Yeah, so I was head of trading by now. So North Square had been set up with a sort of with a risk R bent. So it was looking at a lot of client base that were trading in that sort of special situation, risk arbitrage type.
So what is risk arbitrage in a nutshell for someone listening that may not be aware?
So risk arb is just when company X takes over company Y, they might either say, I'm going to pay $45 a share for this thing, or they might say, I'm going to pay $3 plus 5 of my shares for this thing. So there's a sort of mathematical construct that would exist whereby it would tend to trade at a discount until the day that the deal closes. So the way to trade those things is hopefully, if the deal is going to looks like it probably will go through, there won't be any regulatory pushback. The spread will be quite tight, and if there's a lot of uncertainty around it, they might be wide. And if the deal busts, obviously that spread will collapse rapidly as all those holders, those special situation type holders, are forced out. But North Square and Pally, actually, which I haven't scribbled up on the board, they were pure agency houses. So we were taking on no risk whatsoever. We were set up on the basis that our sales guys had good client relationships with the right houses that were doing a lot of this type of business. And then we could go and source liquidity for them as efficiently as possible. And we had made a name for ourselves for doing a lot of cross-currency type stuff. So it's quite fiddly to do. So if a US company is buying a UK company, there's a sterling dollar FX kicking around in that. And you can't just buy one and sell the other and not hedge out that FX, because obviously if the FX starts to move, you might find that what you thought was a 5% discount you put this thing on is actually a 2%, or even, you know, might even be through the term. So you're not going to make any money. You're going to lose money on it. So you're trading sort of three legs on the trade. You're trading one equity in London, one in the States. And then as that trades, as you're doing a certain clip size, you probably hedge out the FX as you go. And then we got onto more complex stuff. So there was like holding company type trades, which is where a company has stakes in 5 or 6 different companies, which may be listed all over the shop. So there's a fair few over in Sweden, for example, but then they might have holdings in stocks that are listed in the States or whatever as well. So you're running a sort of 6-legged trade, and then 2 of those legs might have different cross-currency components to them. So a lot of it would be spreadsheet-driven from our perspective, just because that was the only way it was really possible to track how much you needed to hedge. But clients would just come on and go, well, look, this is my level where I put it on, 6.3 or whatever it was. And you had to ensure that you got all those 5 or 6 legs of the equity and then the FX hedge to make sure that they were within their limit. So it's quite fiddly trading, and it's not the sort of trading that you would go to a big bank to say, look, can you just make me on risk? Because I'm not sure if they'd make you that price. It was, and you wanted to try and find the liquidity in the underlyings and then just be quick trading to try and get that thing on as efficiently as possible.
So it's interesting, isn't it? Because it shows that across the city there is all sorts of different, you know, business models, strategies being operated, and there's room for a variety of different players. Because yeah, obviously this was a very different operation than, say, you know, ING Barings, which I wouldn't say was a, you know, massive bank, but really was a very big bank compared to different operation. And in terms of North Square, they were backed by someone else, right? Well, there was no relationship with Winterflood or...
So that's correct. When we set up North Square, I mean, I joined, I don't know, I think I was employee 4 or 5. So the 2 guys that had set it up had thought correctly that actually to get it off the ground, it was easier if they were sat within another institution, in this case Winterflood, who we had a good relationship with. So we started off as a sort of agency basis within them. Winterflood themselves are market making type business, so they're taking prices on risk most of the time. So we were slightly different adjunct to them. We weren't really treading on their toes particularly, and also they were very UK focused, whereas we tended to be global, or certainly more. A lot of risk arb would come out of the States and across Europe, so with UK names involved in it as well. But yes, we started with them, and that was that they housed us through it.
And really, that, you know, that solves a problem, doesn't it? Because I imagine being in a small boutique and just trying to get people to accept you as a trading counterpart can be challenging.
Yeah,
that's a big part of the story about, you know, when people are looking at all these opportunities around the street as a graduate, they probably may not be aware of some of these challenges that, that people would be aware that are much further into their career.
Yes, exactly. I think if you, you know, setting up a broker, I mean, it doesn't sound that easy, but I mean, theoretically, one could run off and do it. But actually, as you say, you've got to think about all the counterparty stuff. You've got to get people to deal with you. So, you know, you would, I think we thought in that case, well, if we start with Winterflood, we, not that we're using their balance sheet, but we're using all their operational might to help settle all these things. And it's easier to get people to sign up to face them as a counterparty because they're, you know, they're a venerable city name that's been around for 30 plus years. They've got a decent sized balance sheet, etc. I mean, there are model brokerage out there. I mean, there's things, you know, there's something called Model B, which Pershing run, which is a way whereby you can put down a relatively small amount of capital to allow you to, your client's then going to face them rather than facing you as an entity. So there are ways around it, but you've still got to, you know, get this thing set up and persuade clients to set up with you. And I think in this day and age of KYC, et cetera, people will look very closely at those sort of agreements. It's not as kind of clear and easy as it possibly was.
But I mean, this is what I find really interesting because your and my careers really diverge at this point. And I've gone off into credit world and I'm seeing a lot of different stuff from you. I'm seeing like issuance and how to build a book and all that kind of stuff. But you're really getting into the nitty gritty, you know, and the weeds on, you know, just operationally, you know, getting set up and being able to deal and what does this mean from, you know, from an equity standpoint. It's really interesting. I mean, I really think your knowledge set in that area, you know, talking about, I mean, I have no idea when you say Model B clearing, all this kind of stuff. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, and we had to set up all our, you know, all the systems, all that sort of stuff, you know, EMSs, execution management systems, and OMSs, order management systems. And how you interface through brokers to get access to the live market. Generally, you wouldn't be a member of an exchange yourself. You'd piggyback on somebody else's, and therefore you'd have to pay them a certain amount to do that, through, either through commission or through sort of a flat rate. So, yeah, I got a real feel for how all that plumbing worked, and I think it's really invaluable. And I think a lot of traders probably would have that knowledge now, but certainly back when we started, they absolutely, I mean, people would have to be clueless about that sort of stuff. Just, you know, not on their patch, no interest. You know, they'll just buy them and sell them and hopefully take a turn and off to the pub they go.
So after that, you went across to Seaport, which is an interesting institution because they're quite a big player in the credit space, but you weren't doing credit for them.
No, so they're a very sizable. They have a big US outfit, and then they had a decent presence in London, but absolutely doing distressed mostly. And I think they'd thought that they could, well, they quite wanted to add an equity desk, partly because they, in this day and age, a lot of distressed deals were getting sort of redone as debt for equity swaps. So occasionally they were ending up with equity on their book that they had no way of getting out of. So I think they felt that if they could add an equity book, that one, that would allow them to do that, and two, the risk, we came along as a risk arb desk, a risk arb team. We could then, you know, they could set that up, which would hopefully be revenue generating relatively promptly, and we were. But obviously, it gave them that optionality on any debt equity stuff that they might see, that actually then they had an out for that. And I think they felt that they could cross sell the equity proposition to their credit guys, which worked to a certain degree. But yes, it was that. I mean, that was an interesting place to be. More just from a viewing perspective, it allowed me to have a look at the distress desk. I mean, I never actually traded any of the stuff, unfortunately. But it opened my eyes to another bit of the city I knew absolutely nothing about. You know, I would get their runs every day, and I'd be in the sort of internal chats and see what they were talking about. Completely different, obviously, from the equity side of things. You've got proper price transparency 24/7 really in equities, whereas some of this distressed stuff, you know, there were a lot of Lehman claims and stuff trading through there, and Icelandic Air and stuff. You know, these traded by appointment once every 6 months, so it's very different just seeing that in action. And actually, I think, you know, if a trade was done, you'd have to repaper the trade and all these sort of things to make sure the document's back to back and all that sort of stuff. So not what I was looking at, but I just found it interesting to kind of get a feel for that sort of stuff. You probably may know a bit more on that.
Well, I think it's interesting when you're working like that, you know, it just shows you that you do assimilate, you know, with your desk that are partners. They may not be, you know, the desks that you're working on, but if you're in partnership with them or you're, you know, sharing of information is also very key because, you know, knowledge and information when you're trading, the more information you have to the extreme where you're, you know, insider trading, you can make a lot of money. So, you know, of course, that's key. And it's interesting what you say there about, you know, how you're sitting in chat rooms, seeing what, you know, what other people are doing and how they're, you know, thinking about situations, because that would impact, you know, where you're trading the equity.
Yes, right? And I think they quite liked having an equity team there, just because some of their credit names had equities linked to them. So, you know, and if we were quick on the board on stuff and you could call, oh, you know, there'd been a profit warning in this, then there might be a knock through into the bonds. And actually that's something that they might not have picked up if they'd been a pure bond, credit house. So I think, you know, I'd like to think they found us useful when we were in there. So
moving forward, and I know you did have a little, you know, return into the hedge funds as well, but you came across Discardi. So with all of this equity experience, what have you mostly been working on, Damien?
Not much in equities, far. So I've been here now, finally, I think four and a bit years, shockingly. And most of the stuff I've been working on actually has been in the commodity space. So as I'm sure people are aware, we help, one of our pillars is helping internal audit. And actually, a couple of the audits I've worked on recently have been within commodities, looking at how those desks interface with the market. Certainly the first audit I did was for an agricultural trading house. They themselves are not regulated, but they're using the regulated markets as a way to hedge out the trading they were doing. So they were interested in doing a sort of market conduct review and wanted a feel for just to make sure that they were complying with all the rules and regs around the listed products they were trading. So they were, you know, trading physical underlying, and then they'd be hedging that stuff out in the listed markets. And because they were of a decent size, often they would have, you know, very large positions in this. Quite often through an exempted limit, they could get an exemption to have that because it was physically backed. But it was just looking, it was very interesting to get a feel for that commodity market and be able to speak to traders. I think if you've traded across many asset classes I have, even though I haven't traded that many commodities myself, it's useful to have a trader's hat on when you go and interview another trader rather than, you know, just from an audit perspective.
And what are the sort of the parallels that you've found between, you know, working in equities, you know, from the 90s to commodities now?
I think trading is trading, really. So I think having, there's a lot of nomenclature that sits around trading that seems to be designed to confuse people. Actually, a lot of it is not particularly. But I think if you've sat in a trading desk and you've run risk and you understand what a trader is thinking about on a day-to-day basis, it's very useful when you go to do an audit and you can sit with the audit team and just explain and help translate what the traders are thinking, what they're up to, what their thought process might be around why they've got a position in this or that. That's very powerful and useful from an audit perspective.
Yeah, no, I understand that. Well, I think that's been a rip-roarer through your career. I just want you to signpost a few places because we were probably very bad about talking about sort of time periods and stuff. But if you thought about events that you've traded through at each different place, maybe, could you put a signpost for each one?
I suppose the Asian financial crisis was a flight backwards and far when I was at Caspian. Bearings, I remember vividly, 9/11 really, I suppose, is a kind of real one of those moments. I remember sat on the trading floor and just being in shock. I mean, that was just an unbelievable. And then having to deal with the fact markets were then moving very fast around you. So it was it was, horrible and tough to trade through. And you just saw bids being hit left, right, and centre. And people scurrying for cover or getting out of certain equities. I'm trying to think what else. Lehman's, I haven't actually scribbled it. That was when I was kind of just before McLean. So that was, but then I was at a sort of hedge fund type role there. And that was, you know, we were not very big. I think we had three funds running about $100 million between them. But that was, yeah, very strange, the whole Lehman's event, just not knowing if, you know, I think we banked at RBS as a firm and not knowing almost if you're going to get paid the next day. It was ridiculous. It was just a very, very strange period of time to be trading through. I'm trying to think of other signposts within that. Nothing else is really jumping out at me.
I notice all of the signposts are negative.
Well, true.
So I think that's fantastic, David. Thanks for that sort of rip roar through there. Well, it is the Career Chronicles, and it's with people that are looking for a career perhaps in mind. Any advice to job seekers at all? Any thoughts, any pearls of wisdom for them if they're thinking about finance and a direction to go in maybe?
I think the key for in any career, especially in finance, is networking, really. I think I haven't been so good at it, if I'm brutally honest myself. I think you want to try and get in anywhere, really, and then just, you know, network as hard as you can, always show interest in other products that are out there. You never know. I mean, certainly when I joined, you know, traders were allegedly, equity traders were sort of master of the universe. But, you know, within 3 or 4 years, algorithms had completely destroyed that. You know, ING's equity trading desk would have been, you know, 20, 30, 40 deep. And I should think it's now done by 2 or 3 people. So, you know, I don't think you should necessarily hitch yourself to some sort of product that you think will be, you know, where a lot of money is being made, maybe, you know, looking at the tech stocks now, for example. You know, you've got to be nimble, but also, yeah, network, get out there, get out and meet people, always show interest when you're in a job looking at other roles that are out there, go and speak to analysts, whatever it may be. I think just, I don't know, I'm rabbiting along there. But yeah, I think that would be one of the big takeaways is network hard and make the most of all your contacts.
Well, Damien, thanks very, very much. You've survived the Scardy podcast.
Thank you very much, Nick.
Thank you for listening to the Scardy podcast. On the discussion panel today was Nick Corey and Damien Taylor. If you want to listen to more episodes, just find us by searching the Scardy podcast on any streaming platform. Feel free to connect to us at Scardy Limited on LinkedIn to read about our research and business relation to anti-financial crime and control functions. Thank you for listening.